Sorry about the delay there. Okay, yes, that's me, Chaz Boyd. I'm a program manager in Redmond at Microsoft. I work on the DirectX team, and I'm going to cover a little bit today in a three-hour session what it's like to do a game using the Metro APIs that we now have. I've never used this kind of microphone before. I'm sure I'm going to whack it at least once. Okay. So, as I just said, there was three consecutive talks here, 50 minutes each. This is the first one. We're going to start this off with just an overview of what the game development process is for a lot of small shops that we've worked with. And there's really two phases. There's the production phase and the pre-production phase that is really the fun part, where you get to do prototyping and look development. But first, we have to do introductions. So my actual background is in aeronautical engineering, because that was pretty much the program that they had at the time that was closest to being relevant to games. And there were things like flight simulators that they had in those days. This is 1980, 78 or so. And a lot of computer simulation, a lot of computer graphics. I've started on the DirectX team in 1993, actually, in DX3, so I've been doing this a while. And my favorite games are there. So that should tell you all you need to know about me. Left 4 Dead, yes, okay. Now, the other half of this is I'd like to know you a little better. One of the assumptions that I'm making here, for example, today, is that you're all interested in making money. I know there are a lot of people out there who want to create things in order to express some particular inner need they have, perhaps. But I'm assuming that you're here because you'd like to actually be able to earn some money making games. So is that right?
Yep.
Okay. How many of you are JavaScript HTML web people, programmers? Any of those here? Okay. How many people are big fans of C#? XAML and those types of things. Okay. How many people still remember how to program in C++? Okay, good. Great. Okay. Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. Okay. So first, we want to cover a little bit of what we call the opportunity. How many of you went to the keynote this morning? Everybody? Right? Okay, so I won't go into this too much. But really, the story is that Windows is expanding into an even broader range of hardware devices than it's ever had. So not only do we have at the very high end, dual SLI cards that have hundreds of gigabytes of performance on them, gigabytes per second. We also have small devices. I've actually got one here. This is thinner than the iPad 1. It's the Nike PC from the Build conference. It plays World of Warcraft, so that's really what you need to know there. And so that's really, and we're in the process of making even smaller devices than that. So given that, we have to keep in mind that there are already 1.25 billion people using PCs out there today. The number of Windows 7 seats that we've sold up through last Christmas, end of calendar year, is 5.25. Well, okay, almost 500 million right there. And then this is the number of PCs that Gartner, not us, is projecting will be sold over the next, probably during calendar 2013, I would say. 2012, it says. Okay. And then of all those PCs that are out there, the 400 million new ones, and the probably there's 100 million or so people will upgrade their existing Windows 7 machine to Windows 8. That adds up to a pretty significant number of PC sockets available for your applications to run on in about 12 months from now. Now, okay, you want to do a game? Let's see what that looks like for games. If we actually look at the amount of money that was spent on games last year, It's about 70 billion worldwide. Of those 125 billion people that are playing games, that are running PCs today, pretty much all of them have at least tried a game a little bit, if you count things like solitaire. And then the total revenue that we're seeing here, 21 billion, that is just from phone and tablet gaming. So again, gaming is a pretty significant fraction of the PC space, which is also pretty huge to begin with. These numbers are from IDC. Okay, and the interesting opportunity is this. I'm going to talk a little bit about this. The device spectrum that PCs are spanning now starts with these lightweight tablets and runs all the way up to, like I said, those gaming rigs that have massive numbers of graphics cards inside. And then if you actually think of it a little bit, there's the phone on this end and maybe consoles on that end, right? So there's a big span of devices out there right now. And so the question is going to be, for a new developer starting out, what is the point along this spectrum that you really want to hit? And that's what I'm going to try and cover in the next few slides. The thing that's interesting now is, given the breadth of PCs, it's not just someone sitting at their desk in the den doing their taxes. The user's going to be in a different situation now than he's using his PC. He may be on the couch, he may be on the train, he may have it on their bedstand by the side of the bed when they want to read at night. There's just a whole bunch of new opportunities for people to be using these devices that they couldn't use a PC before. And those are all new opportunities for people to potentially play games as well. When you have a PC that's more portable, you're more likely to have it with you. But on the other hand, you're also more likely to be interrupted by something else going on. You've got a smaller amount of time. So the average session that people are using these lower-end PCs for is not quite as long as a multi-hour text session or a World of Warcraft raid. The other thing is there's now a variety of input methods that shifts as we shift up and down this spectrum. At the low end, you want to do touch more because it's more portable. You don't have to carry a stylus. But on the high end, we still have people using mouse and keyboard. And the question is going to be, where do people transition during their day as they choose which device to use for their PC activities? Which will they pick as their input mechanisms as well? So the solution for Windows 8 is simple. We offer them all as far as input devices, but it's up to you guys to optimize the choice of input schemes for your applications based on the situations that you expect your users to be in. Another varying factor up and down the string is network quality. As these devices are more portable, you're more likely to be somewhere far away. You're on 3G. You don't have good Wi-Fi. You certainly don't have a wired connection. And then on the high end, you may have a full-on multi-megabyte per second link. So that's another characteristic to keep in mind as you're targeting your products along this spectrum. Another variation is just the total amount of display size. It's not really that much of a difference because a typical 30-inch monitor, people sit back a little further than they will from a 10-inch tablet. They'll hold a little bit closer. So the actual field of view that's spanned is not really that much different, but it's still something that you have to keep in mind when you're targeting your content as well. And then also another major difference is the processor performance, both on the graphics processor and the system CPU processor. There's a fair amount of variation as we go up and down this scale. I think that's really what we see as the biggest way to improve performance. I mean, improve battery life is to trade off a little bit of performance. And then conversely, these SLI rigs that are plugged into the wall have, in some cases, over a kilowatt power supply. So it's a range. Now, one of the other aspects of the graphics processor is that there's variation in the feature set as well. As we start with some of these devices have got DX9 chips, and then some of the other more recent ones have DX10 chips. And right now, we're seeing just now the majority of the units shipping or actually showing up on the surveys today are starting to be DX11 chips. So you've got that those three choices as well. And then, of course, each of these configurations may have a different amount of memory. I think at the low end, we see potentially some 1 gig, maybe 2 gig machines. And then at the high end, people have got 12 and 16 gigabyte machines. So there's some variation there as well. And then what that affects also is when you're producing content for somebody, you have this app package size, which is really how big is your product when you give it to the customer. And if they're on a big, fat internet connection, then you can give them a multi-gigabyte package. But if they're on a 3G connection and they're far away or they're on the train, you want to keep it small so that you know, they can download it and still have time to play it before they get where they're going. Okay, so there's this variation of spectrum all up and down that product line, but there are some aspects that are pretty much consistent across those products. It's looking like pretty much every processor, even in the phones, is going to have at least two cores. So being able to support multi-threading and multi-processing looks like it's here to stay. The display resolution in terms of pixel density is also not changing. In fact, we're seeing there are cell phones now that are 720p. It may be that there'll be tablets that are coming out at 1080p. And then, of course, a lot of these desktop systems are 1080p. So 1080p, because of the Blu-ray phenomenon, really ends up being a standard that spans all of these devices. And then, of course, the quality of the displays is getting pretty uniform and pretty good these days. Okay, so now this is where I'm going to make some suggestions here. From looking at this spectrum of data along this curve, there is kind of a place where there isn't a lot of attention being paid by software developers today. And that's kind of in this, I guess it's shifted down towards the more mobile devices. There's not a lot of applications out there that are really designed for, say, a 20-minute commute. They're designed for a few minutes, maybe an Angry Birds type thing, or they're designed for a 1 hour, half hour Left 4 Dead session. Not a lot of content in that 20-minute spot. There's also not a lot of PC games out there today that are really exploiting touch and accelerometer, which would enable them to go down into the more mobile form factors. Very few people are implementing tablet-oriented content that benefits from network connections. Even though they all have typically a 3G connection, there's very little sort of multiplayer activity going on. And what's going to happen soon is, as the number of tablets increases, it's likely that a given household will have more than one. As soon as that happens, then the two people are going to want to play some game. Maybe it's Scrabble, maybe it's a deathmatch shooting game. But there's a whole spectrum of those that, if you're running on the same Wi-Fi, you're sitting in the same living room, you can be facing each other over the top of your tablets and get a sort of social experience that you can't get from a console. On a console, you're elbowing the other person, maybe, as far as social interaction. But, when you're looking at them over the top of your tablet, you can taunt them or whatever sort of interaction you want. And that's just a scenario that's not really being well supported today by any content that I'm aware of. And then another thing is, it's not absolutely necessary to have these mobile devices using visuals that are cartoonish, right? It doesn't have to look that way. A lot of those, all of those chips have the performance and feature set to deliver extremely realistic content for simple objects like a dice game or even playing cards or billiards or, pachinko. You can do extremely photorealistic rendering of those objects as a visual style if you wanted to, just that no one's really choosing to do that today. And then the other thing is there's kind of a sweet spot around the 300 megabytes to 1 gigabyte download size that's really not being exploited today. A lot of the high-end games are coming on dual-layer DVDs, and they're 7 gigabytes, or the Blu-ray ones are 25 gigabytes. And then, of course, a lot of the cell phone games are running around 100 megabytes or something a little larger than that. But in between there, there's an opportunity that no one's really targeting that space right now in terms of the scale of the experience that you can deliver with that much data. So, to summarize it, down here in these form factors is where the new opportunities lie. These are the places where, as a new developer starting out, there's not a lot of existing content that's targeted at that space, and that's why it's a really good opportunity for, small indie shops to pick it up. Now, another aspect of this is not just sort of the space where we are on the on this curve, but also the timing as well. So in the early phase of a new platform, like I remember from the Amiga or the Atari or those types of devices, in the early phase, it was hard to write code. There weren't really good tools. There wasn't a lot of infrastructure. There wasn't other existing code to leverage in your product. So, and there wasn't really that big of a market in terms of the installed base of those devices either. But what there was a lack of competition. Conversely, when a particular platform is in a mature phase, you do have an easy time creating content because there are lots of stable middleware and good tools and lots of other resources for people on the web. And you have a large install base of sockets. But on the downside of that is that many of the participants in that field will be well-funded, large, entrenched players that can dominate the space. So that's why here at the early phase of what amounts to the Metro platform, we have an opportunity for new companies starting out to get something that's very important, which is visibility. Visibility is probably one of the toughest things to acquire as a new shop starting out. It has so much impact on your revenue, and it's so hard to acquire. Just, you know, trying to get the word out is a huge problem. So that's why now, when we're in the early phase of the Metro platform, is the time for new companies starting up, just individual people, 1 to 3 person shops. Those are the ones that have their chance to become the next Rovio, for example. And this platform is going to be huge. So if you can get a significant visibility in the early phase of the platform and then maintain that mind share as the platform grows, then yeah, that's a pretty big upside, as the suits would say. So the fundamental message is, if you're a big shop that already has a brand name that everybody else already knows, then maybe you want to wait a little while and then until the install base fills up, because you know everybody knows about your product and they're just going to buy it whenever it comes out. And so if there's more units in the field, maybe you'll make more money. But that's not true for the indie. On the indie, you need to get in there early to be able to get the visibility right away. Okay. Now, to prove this, I think it's good for anybody starting out to do a little bit of market research on what they would like to do. And there are sources out there today that let you cover this information. A lot of them are free. I wouldn't worry about that too much. Many of them have reports that are fairly expensive, but you know, they also work. They realize that small app developers are a growing market, so they're relatively open to providing some information. A lot of app stores that are out there today actually let you see the results of other, or the sales volumes of other applications. So that's an interesting way to decide what sort of product you want to make. What we're getting into here is a little bit of, as we start the development process, once we've decided that, hey, the opportunity is large enough, it's going to be a question of then how do we decide what type of product to build. And this is one of the ways to do it. Another thing I actually rely on quite a bit is the Steam survey. They provide a lot of detail in terms of what the hardware configurations that are out there in the field today that would help you target your product at different form factors. Okay, so really what we're getting into now is what I would call, like we called in the outline, the pre-production phase. And this is where you kind of work out some rough ideas about how your product is going to look, what it's going to be about, what it's going to look like, and you know, that market data will be useful for that part. Now, the range of types of products is pretty huge, and so you don't necessarily want to throw out ideas right away. Early on, You want to look at a variety of configuration types of titles. In the early days, in the 80s, Chris Crawford, who was probably one of the earliest writers on the field of game design, he's all in Wikipedia now, so it's really good, categorized these types of applications into three categories. A toy is really something that's just fun to mess around with. I guess an example is just sort of a doodling, make pretty colors program, or just bouncing balls around with your accelerometer. Some of those desktop Newton's Cradle type things. People will play with those for quite a while. But it doesn't really have a goal. If you define a goal for the toy, as in arrange these pieces in some particular pattern, then it becomes what we would call a puzzle, or what Chris called a puzzle. And so there's a whole separate category of games that are puzzles. And really they're just a, you know, find something to play with and then give the user a goal to solve with that. And then if you give the player an opponent, even just a clock to beat or some kind of score, then it becomes what you would call a game, because there can actually be back and forth between the player and that alternative opponent. So that's really a kind of a spectrum of complexity or differences of experience. And it's important to consider when you're especially starting out, one of your objectives is going to be to try to come up with a very minimal product to get some visibility out there and then be able to upgrade it over time. You don't want to really start with saying, I'm going to go home next week and I'm going to write World of Warcraft. There's no downside to starting small and then building up. So don't necessarily throw away some of these things. Like, you could say, for example, that Minecraft is a toy. It's just a way to go out there and play with these cubes. And I think, judging from the people that I've seen play it, most people spend a lot of their time more in that toy mode than they are actually trying to, you know, get away from monsters or something like that. And this is an interesting aspect of your title to track, because it's going to influence how you handle your monetization. If you've got a product that is, you play through the five levels and you're done, then the total amount of time that people are playing your product isn't that great, and maybe you don't want to use an advertising-based monetization model for that. But you probably want to try to get some money up front, because it's a relatively fixed duration experience. But if you've got something where if a person really gets into that game and they could play it time and time again, maybe just a few minutes a day, but for weeks and weeks, then that's the type of title that you would want to target an ad-based revenue model for. So the typical game development process is actually kind of factored into four different roles. We'll get into those roles specifically in a bit. But one of them is actually designing the actual gameplay. And if you want to have it's important to, I believe, to at least understand what else is going on out there in that space. So you can look at existing toys. You can actually look at physical puzzles in the real world, for example. And you can look at arcade games. Now, the reason I look at arcade games, and I think it's important for everybody to understand those, is that in the 80s, there was a big surge. It lasted from, I think, 77 to 84 when it kind of crashed. During that time period, sort of the life cycle of that platform, pretty much every possible combination of things you could do with sprites was tried out, right? So somewhere in there, they basically conjugated the space. Everything that could be done was tried. And now some games since then, are somewhat derivative of those ideas, but really the fundamental core concepts really arose in that era. Another source of resource material for understanding games that's out there today is Gamma Sutra. Particularly the features on the Gamma Sutra website are particularly interesting. Then, of course, there's a lot of materials from the game developer conferences in the U.S. They have a few of those across, and then there are conferences in Europe as well. There's a lot of web forums out there. There's an organization called Casual Connect, which sponsors game conferences. And then, of course, there are local groups. I mean, plenty of cities have got a game development club chapter that meets at the local tavern once a month or so. So those are good places to develop contacts. If you're looking at at inspiration, I would say, for visual design, okay, who here knows about the demo scene? Okay, because in the States, nobody's ever heard of the demo scene. But here you guys have access to this and understand, you know, what it means. So there's a huge number of creative ideas that are coming out there, both in the art side and in terms of the visuals and the animation and the graphics techniques. And the other thing I want to say about this, when we get into a little bit on creativity, is that that is a culture of people who are working, they embrace the constraints of the medium, and from that are able to find creative solutions that are, you know, just absolutely spectacular. Okay, concept art. You can just look on the web. A lot of things, if you're looking at the pictures of how do I make my dice or my playing cards or my billiard balls look photorealistic, look at photos of them. Okay, and then this is another opportunity that I think is really unique to the situation that we're in right now. But there's this phase that you go in through, the early phase of the product development, called look development, where you're trying to come up with a unique visual style. And the opportunities there are huge. I've got here, you know, Roman mosaics could be the visual motif of your title. You could have animated characters constructed of little pieces of stone, for example. A variety of painting styles, watercolors, oils, pointillism. There's visual patterns from the Egyptians or from the Greeks. There's standard woodcut carvings and block prints. There's shadow puppets. And there's a whole spectrum of unique visual looks that are out there today that you could make a game that works in those visual styles and then be visually unique to everybody on the, you know, relative to all the possible competitors. So this is really what I think is the biggest advantage of this situation in terms of the opportunity, is that it used to be in the past that you really couldn't do this type of innovation. Really what happened before is if you wanted to earn any money at all, you had to have a relationship with the publisher and probably invest, you know, there would be projects would be millions of dollars to just get started and get out there and get them shipped. And because that amount of money was being invested, usually by someone else, they would not be willing to take a huge amount of risk in terms of innovation in, say, things like visual style or new types of gameplay. On the other hand, the hobbyist had complete freedom to implement any sort of visual style or gameplay element they wanted, but they typically didn't get any money because it was very difficult to get a title out there and get it visible and you know, actually still have a sane billing model for it. So the nice thing about the Metro platform is that it combines those. You have a chance of getting an actual revenue stream from your title. It doesn't have to be given away on a freeware website. And so you can invest actual effort into producing that title. But on the other hand, there's nobody breathing down your neck and saying, okay, don't try anything funny with my money now. So this is really the opportunity that I think is kind of unique in history right now. This is resulting, I've seen today already, in a certain amount of renaissance in the game space itself, in both these areas for new types of gameplay and visual styles. I did want to say one thing, okay? This is a blank screen. There's really, in some sense, nothing more scary than that. Because when you're just starting out, you're saying, okay, there's my blank screen, what do I put in it? And the answer is, well, I could put anything there. Anything. And then you start losing it. Because it's this paradox of choice kicks in, and you go, I don't know what to do with that. And so what a good solution to that problem is to do kind of like what Minecraft did and some of these other titles is find the limitations of the medium and incorporate them into your design as a theme, as a way to, improve your product. And in some cases, what we've seen people do is they'll actually insert their own constraints on their blank sheet of paper to give themselves guidance. For example, the Minecraft guys, I think I got these slides out of order. The Minecraft guys basically said, hey, what could we do under the assumption that everything in the world is a 1 meter cube? And turned out to be great. They've created an entire universe under that rule, and it kind of freed them to do all these things by not having to worry about the case, well, okay, what happens if it's a sphere? What happens if it's a cylinder? They don't have to worry about any of those things. And so it really ends up being an inspiration for creativity. And this was my point I was making earlier on about the other advantage of being a small shop is that you can be small and you can be agile and you can get something out there and then collect feedback on it from telemetry, from the store, and so on. And then iterate, improve it based on customer feedback, and then send an update, or eventually, once you've got enough experience on that, create a new title. It's really the interesting thing is to incrementally grow your business. Also, this is another thing that happens during the early conceptual phases is you want to come up with some names. And the reason this is important to do fairly early on is because people are going to want to talk about your game on Twitter and Facebook and all those, and you might even want to use a domain name. So in order to sign up for those things, you need to have some thought into what the namings of all the things are going to be, like what's the name of your company and what's the name of the product, and it's one of the fun parts. Okay, so let's say that we've got all those aspects done, we're completed on the portion of the pre-production phase, we've done the brainstorming and decided on what our visual style is going to be and what our core gameplay elements are going to be. Maybe even, prototyped a little bit of that. Now we're going to see what the individual roles are that are involved in kind of setting up the shop to get started. In the second half that I'm just, and we're not really going to go into a lot of production. Basically the next talk in the next hour is just the coding aspect, and then there's some optimization stuff in the third hour. So here I'm going to just talk a little bit about these four different roles and what you do in the early phase. Now, you don't have to have four people to do those roles. You can just switch hats, one person. I'm going to be a biz guy today, put on a suit. I'm going to be a coder, whatever. That works too. But it's important to try and to not get too confused between them all. It can be really confusing when you're trying to, do two of them at the same time. Okay, so if we're the game designer and we're just starting out, one of the things we need to do is organize the results that came out of that sort of brainstorming session in the pre-production phase into something that looks, structured, that you'll be able to manage going forward. Identify some of the key algorithms that particular scenario is going to need. Make sure that the gameplay elements of it are actually entertaining. And a lot of people do this type of prototyping using paper cutouts and handwritten notes. So if you've got dummy objects like that, like maybe real dice or playing cards, that works as well. Okay, if you're in the artist role, you're responsible really for the visual style of the experience. You again need to organize the decisions that were made around what sort of visual style should be. You need to prototype the visual effects that you're going to have that follow that style. So for every element in your game, like the ball or the player or the goal or whatever, come up with a visual representation of that that's consistent with the overall style that you're trying to hit for that title. Then you also need to go around and look, make sure you've got the right tools. Do I have a recent version of Photoshop? What other sort of, do I need any 3D tools? What sort of paint programs do I need? Make sure that you're set up in that way. And then when you've got those tools, you can start playing with them to identify what are the quick ways to produce the visual styles that you're going to need. Because once you get into production, you're really going to be potentially cranking out large numbers of sprites or animation frames or something. And being able to find efficient ways to do that and is very important. So you'll want to write down those lists of steps that you go through in terms of processing your art content to make sure that you can automate that process very efficiently once you're further down the road. And then the other thing that I recommend is when you put your art hat on is really look at some of the visuals that you're about to stick up for your first screenshot or to go on your Facebook page and make sure that they're not something that you'll be embarrassed by in a year or so. So that's another thing to watch out for. Okay, on the software side, you guys know all this. You got to set up a build machine. You probably have to have the tools installed on it. You have to decide what language you're going to write it in first, I guess, and then install the tools for that. And then try to get something up and running. Now, this is one of the key elements of starting out is you need to get something running right away. And it's not going to be the final visuals. It's not going to be the final gameplay. But the problem is there are very many elements of an interactive scenario, like a game, that you cannot work out beforehand on a static piece of paper. Things like the way that creatures move or that just gameplay elements move around is movement, it's behavior, and you really can't tune that or design it or start working with it on paper. You have to get at least a placeholder systems up and running. So there are plenty of cases where people have got the whole game running, but everything is a cube or everything is just the bounding box on the screen. Or, in some cases they'll just have, blobby shapes or paper cutouts that says, your name here, and they move around. But it allows you to get unblocked in terms of the dependencies that the different roles have on each other, right? Your gameplay designer really can't start doing design of the gameplay until you've got something that actually plays. So that's kind of the incentive there. It's kind of not the waterfall model, right? You don't do all this spec work and then at the end you write this cool thing. You have to be up and running on a lot of these things to begin with. And if you just have to start with one of these existing sample apps and then start tweaking that, at least you're getting up and running. Okay, now the rest of this talk is mostly going to be about the business person's hat. And first thing they need to do is validate, check some of those marketing resources to make sure it looks like this is actually going to be a viable product. Make sure that based on the type of experience you're trying to deliver, if it's a short one-off thing versus a multiple continuous, we call it evergreen product, then you want to make sure that you've got some story either for adding DLC over time or paid elements or subscription or possibly advertising based. Make sure that aligns because, if you skip this step, you'll have a really cool game, it'll be a lot of fun, and you'll still be a hobbyist not making any money. Then there's a bunch of paperwork you have to do. You have to sign up for the store. You have to sign up for Facebook and Twitter accounts to publicize the thing. You have to look into domain names and hosting for that. And these are all relatively simple and mostly paperwork type activities, but it's fairly important to get them done at some point. And then there are a bunch of advantages to actually becoming an LLC. It's a little bit more paperwork, but it's something that if you have a biz person or if you have a day or two of the week that you feel like you could be a biz person, then you can look into that as well. Okay, so there's another talk apparently this afternoon on the store. Those will have more detail than what I'm going to give you right now, but we've got a little bit of information on what it takes to get your product in the store. Like I said, the next hour's talk is all about what it's like to be the programmer. This talk I'm going to cover a little bit more about what it's like to be the business person. So, as I said, these are your monetization options. I think every single one of those is not correct. You've got time-limited trials, which is a very simple checkbox when you submit your application. You can have feature-differentiated trials in which some features don't function until they've until they've actually registered for the full product. Then you've got the original purchase model for some of those short period games. You can go ad supported, or you can, if you've got an existing business model already built with somebody, that's one of the things that's kind of challenging for people to understand. Microsoft is only really required to be involved for the installer. We install your application, we replace the Install Shield installer app. You don't have to use us for billing. What that means is that basically we're distributing your app out to all of your customers for free. If you want to use our billing service, we think it is, you know, the best that's out there today, especially in terms of price. But if you already have an existing relationship with some other online sales company like Impulse or Steam or Origin or all the other ones that I probably shouldn't name, then yeah, go ahead and use that billing model. We're fine with that. And I did want to point here is that there's also this concept of the way licensing works. When you purchase a product from the Microsoft Store, you basically, it'll install for free on like the next 5 machines you log in on. And there's a bunch of also flexibility about like what happens if another person logs into that same machine. Well, the fact is they get to play it too. So it's very, very, lot of flexibility that we're offering in terms of how you want to offer your content to people, what sort of monetization strategy you want to use. And then we saw this slide this morning. This is based on the phone data. It's a really good idea to have trials. They're very popular and they do help increase the visibility and the actual download rate and revenue of your title. In-app offers are also an interesting supplement. They keep your application in the user's mind, or the larger number of users in their mind for a longer time. So if you have the option to extend it by adding expansion packs or new skins for the visuals or so on, that's another particularly useful business model. Okay, and this is the story on the store. We saw this morning also. But really fundamentally, as I said earlier on, the biggest challenge that you face starting out is getting people to see your product, getting people to hear about it. And so every opportunity that you have for increasing your visibility, for getting visibility for that product, is critical. And the nice thing about the store is it at least provides at least one point of presence for you to be in the store. And that website on the store will end up being indexed by the search engines. It can be, you can send links to it anywhere, so people can send each other links to it in Facebook or Twitter or just SMS. So we're trying to make sure that there are as many ways as possible to funnel people and have them hear about your product. But getting in the store is a really good start with that. Then it's up to you to try and manage those mechanisms to make sure that even more people hear about it over time. And again, there's a lot of advantage to really making sure that your application runs in a variety of geographies, because that acts as a multiplier on the visibility. It increases the chance that you're going to find someone who really likes that title. And again, as I said, our billing service, if you want to use it, is still the best, because after $25,000 of gross revenue, we will take only 20% instead of 30% like everybody else does. And then, of course, you've got options to do your own pricing. Right now, I did want to add that the maximum package size that you can upload to the store right now is 2 gigabytes. So that's something to keep in mind. It's possible to deliver a pretty incredible experience with 2 gigabytes of content, as some of the titles out there today will show. And then, of course, as I'll talk about this afternoon, the nice thing about the store is that the process by which you submit your app to it is comprehensible. That's kind of the point of it all, is that each of the steps that you go through is clearly delineated, and you know where you are along that process, you know what you have to do next, and it's really not that many steps. The effort that we're making right now is to make it so that there is nothing in those steps that is surprising or unknowable to you. Really, one of the approaches that we use is we give you the acceptance test so you can run it on your machine before you even submit it. And that is pretty much the same code that we're going to run at our end to make sure that it doesn't crash, for example. And then the other things we do, we pretty much run a lot of virus scanners on it, and then work through some database issues about getting it distributed to all the different places it would need to be distributed. And that's the work that we do. But it's not intended to be that there's some secret tricks that we have behind the back. And then again, as I mentioned before, there's this concept of telemetry. You can provide, you can go onto your dashboard and see the status of your title in terms of how it's doing in different territories. You can use that as feedback to shape future updates or modifications to your title over time. Okay. These are all good advice for how to set up your billing model effectively, but it helps a lot, for example, if you tell people clearly in your description page what they get for the trial version and what they get for the money version, because if that's not clear and they don't see that there's significant value in upgrading to the paid version, they're not as likely to do it. And then the more you can keep your customers involved in the title, the more it's likely to become big. Now, there are some examples that we've seen in the industry of people being successful, and there's really four things that we see that contribute to that success, pretty much guarantee it. If you came up during your pre-production phase with a great concept, something that's innovative and novel and people haven't experienced before, that's a huge attraction to the game is I've never seen anything like this before. Novelty is a big factor. And if you've got a really entertaining concept there, that'll do you very well. Then you have to make sure that you don't have any crashing bugs, for example, in your implementation of it. You need to make sure that the experience is polished from the initial discovery when the person first hears about it from one of their Facebook friends or on a website. And then from then on, it's very easy. There are no missing steps about getting into the game and starting to have fun. So that has to do with your initial launch user interface, your splash screen works, how many clicks does it take before I can actually start playing. Those are all aspects of polishing that initial experience for the user. Then you have to work on making sure that you broadcast information about your product to as many different media as possible. And then, of course, make sure your business model is actually aligned with the type of title that it is. And another thing I want to recommend is talk to other people. You may have relatives, you may have friends who want to be beta testers. There's a lot of ways that different people can help in these sorts of things. Also, there's the whole Kickstarter process, which is, produced quite a few successes if you really want to get into that level of money. Okay, so the point of all of this is now is an extremely good time to get into this space, especially in games. One of the advantages of doing a game is that, other than making sure it's bug-free, people don't expect it to be supported for like 10 years. If it's an SMS reader, they want to rely on that, and you're going to have support calls for a long time. But with a game, especially if it's a simple experience, they play it, they pay their money, and you don't have to necessarily, have a support organization for a long time. So that means that potentially the effort versus revenue for games is actually pretty good. So That's the opportunity. The game is the good is an excellent way to take advantage of that opportunity. You can download all the bits today, and you can start implementing this. We have a couple sample apps that are out there now. There's one called Marble Maze, another one called Simple 3D Game, that are pretty much like a starter kit that you could start turning into an actual product, tomorrow. Okay, and that's pretty much it for my talk today.